had a great deal to say on this subject of logos. He used to speak about how the Greek word logos was much like the Latin word ratio, something polyvalent in its meaning and therefore untranslatable with a single word. It is the insight of my guest tonight that this word logos gave the evangelist St. John the ability to communicate the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ to the Greco-Roman world with a success previously unachieved. So without any further ado, I'll bring on Dr. Jones. Good evening, Dr. Jones.
Good evening, brother.
Thank you for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome.
Now,
good to be here.
Thank you. I've entitled this show, What and Who is Logos? So let's get right to the what and consider logos as we know it from the Greek philosophers. So could you talk for a moment about the pre-Socratics like Heraclitus and some of the others who started to talk about logos in a philosophical way?
Yes. There's never been a time when human beings did not speak about God, have a word for God, have some type of understanding that God was a father who lived in the sky. And they knew this, and they began to speculate on these ideas. And they went down a blind alley called mythology. And one of the best explanations, examples of mythology would be Homer's poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, where you have gods who are really not gods, okay? They're kind of superheroes, superhuman beings that get into fights and quarrels with each other and have favorites down here on Earth and so on and so forth. They're not God, okay? It's clear that these are not, even if you use the plural, you can't say that it's God. As soon as you're using the plural, you're in bad territory.
Uh-huh.
One of the people who figured this out was Socrates, and as a result, he wanted to ban poetry because he felt that these gods gave bad example. Zeus would turn himself into some type of form and have sexual intercourse with women. So it was a bad idea. It was a dead end, and the smarter Greeks knew that. What happened in Ionia, which is the western shore of Asia Minor, Greek colonies there in cities like Miletus, is the birth of what was probably considered physics, trying to see if the world could give us some understanding of what ultimate reality was. So they had the sense there's an ultimate reality because everybody has this sense. They had a sense that mythology was just stories for children. And so we're not going to go down that path. We're going to look at the world and see what it can tell us about ultimate reality. And so the first man to do this was Thales, who said everything was water. And then Anaxagoras came along and said everything was air. And at this point, you're starting to see these elements, these physical elements, start to have meaning above and beyond themselves. So you could say that if everything's water, is the beginning of things water? Water was a symbol for chaos, and that's what Hesiod had said in the Theogony. The chaos was at the beginning. But then when you get to air, you're getting even more spiritual, if you want to talk about that, in terms of an element. It's surrounding us. We live and move and have our being in this. We breathe it in. We breathe it out. It became symbolic of the soul. It's spiritus, is breath and soul. So we're getting more and more abstract. And then Heraclitus comes along and says it's fire. And that's a kind of modern understanding because fire is another word for energy, and there's something to that. Werner Heisenberg would agree with that in some sense. But he also started going beyond that. He started using the word logos. And in this, we have a term that is completely immaterial, completely spiritual, and this was the launching pad for metaphysics.
I think it's noteworthy that the historians of philosophy tell us that Heraclitus was the first one to come up with systematized philosophical thought, and he was also the first one to use logos in this philosophical way that you just described.
Yes. Some people feel he was a Persian. You have this confluence of Greek and Persian culture because it's the Persian Empire that rules Asia Minor, and this is on these are Greek colonies in Asia Minor. And some people say that Heraclitus got the idea of fire from Zoroastrianism, which worships fire. Yes, there's a contested issue here about the relationship between Heraclitus and Parmenides, because Parmenides was also important. Nobody even knows who came first. It could be that Heraclitus came first and said that everything is flux and being, and Parmenides came afterwards and said, no, that's not true. There's no change at all. But Parmenides is important because he started talking about being, a completely abstract term. And his famous statement was basically that that which is cannot come from that which is not, which is an incredibly profound statement, if you think about it, because it's basically the refutation of Darwin.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, and of course, the reconciliation. So you're talking about the two ancient schools of Iona and Elia, the Eleatic and the Ionic schools. They had they were profoundly in conflict, but the resolution of that conflict gives us an awful lot of insight. As you just said, once you understand being and this principle of stasis that Parmenides appreciated, and then you understand the concept of flux and change that Heraclitus gives us insights into, then the concepts of substance and change and accident and all these things take on, those suddenly answer the questions that were asked by these earlier guys, right?
No, I don't think they answered any questions. They posited something, and then you come up with a kind of paradox and a conundrum. Zeno was a follower of Parmenides and created his paradoxes basically to refute the critics of Parmenides, but they're paradoxes.
Yeah.
And you just kind of stand there and scratch your head and you think, how does this all fit together?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is it doesn't.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean to suggest that they were asking questions that the later philosophers actually answered. What I meant was in their saying what they did and bringing out these conflicts between these two different schools and Zeno's, like proving that an arrow could never reach from the archer to the tree and these unprovable things. The whole concept is that they were sort of bumping around in the dark, and later philosophers would come up with the insights needed to answer them and to bring out the truth in contrast to the error that was in these early systems.
Yeah. But the ultimate result of the pre-Socratics was that everybody, it just collapsed.
Uh-huh.
Because they were examining the world as they saw it, and they didn't have instruments to examine it in any greater detail. There's no such thing as a microscope or a telescope at this point. And so they just said, well, that's about as far as we can go. And then nobody went any farther, and they just shifted the focus and shifted into more human concerns. And more things like how to win lawsuits and stuff like that. And this group was known as the Sophists.